get enough of insurance, so put in another 30 minutes.
An hour, I thought.
No, you'll get it done in 30 minutes.
Go ahead.
Okay, the second section of the paper still deals with the mechanics of, if you were to unlock the shareholder shares, the mechanics of adjusting the margin. The paper in paragraphs 49 to 54 outlines three alternatives. And we would like to, your comments and questions about what amount you think should adjust the construction service margins. Again, putting aside whether you would or wouldn't do it, it's more to be able to assess the cost benefits of doing it. Which sort of mechanics are we looking at?
Mary?
I'll start by saying when I looked at the standalone selling price, I guess I had both operational concerns about it as well as conceptual concerns. So my preference would be not to explore this one any further. My conceptual concerns were if we are taking a piece of actual return on assets and recharacterizing it as fee, you know, as implicit fee. to say when I'm going to be the insurer for a minute, when I have decided that I'm going to take some risking because of the variability of returns and convert it by saying it's as if it's a specified fee that isn't actually agreed between me and the policyholder, just seems to be, it reminds me of searching everywhere for embedded derivatives. You know, it just reminds the chase of the hypothetical, and I wouldn't go that route. An operational, turning to the operational side, one thing that came to mind as I looked at it, was, well, if you're looking to the market and how the market prices these services, presumably you would then have some kind of adjustment to what the market would charge if it were an explicit fee, because you're taking further risk, and that's another layer of subjectivity. So I think we're just getting to how much of an anchor would you really have if you were looking at the market. So I don't see that as being workable.
Okay. Then can I ask you, since you're the one who wanted to go first, A or B?
A or B? Sorry.
Paragraph 49.
No, I think I answered question 2, which is no. Yes, I do have comments, and no, I don't think we should pursue it further.
Okay. All right. And Patrick, you put up your hand.
Well, I was answering for Mary, but if I were to go down this path, I would go down 49A.
Okay.
I don't really see a good basis for using the approach in B.
Is the rest of the board?
I don't think we should be doing this at all, but if we were doing it, I think it should. The standalone selling price doesn't seem to bear any relationship to this notion of a fixed fee that we set in the first criteria. So I wouldn't do that one, because while there are lots of reasons why it sounds like a good idea, if we're going to have the criteria in the first part that it has to be a stated minimum, then I think we've got to stick with the stated minimum. And that's what it should be.
Okay.
And I'm not sure that any of these three are the stated minimum then?
Well, you could have the stated minimum for A and B. The difference is whether the stated minimum should be based on whether your assets are measured on different bases, or whether you want that stated minimum to be just cash flows discounted present value like all other cash flows.
And consistent with day one measurement.
Yes.
There's a distinction, in my view, in A and B, is that
yes.
A is the present value of your
yes.
cash flow, considering the discount rates in your cash flow. That B is your expectation for the future cash flows, for the future assets that you hold.
Yeah, it's more tied into how those assets are accounted for.
Yeah.
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 I'm pretty sure C, under 49, C would be a pure guess.
Sorry, what's that?
Under 49, C would be a pure guess, I suppose.
Okay. Be a what?
Pure guess, because I don't think there is any standard selling price for such an implicit fee, which is based on a pure invention of a fee in a contract where there is no stated fee. So to try to find a market participant view, an implicit fee in a contract, which, by the way, is mostly unique to this insurance company, because this arrangement is unique to this company, would not work at all. Between A and B, I feel that I may be wrong, that A would create more mismatches than B, which would align with the way you measure assets or the way you measure liabilities.
Is it true? Expectations.
Yeah. It potentially could. And it's a question here, again, of whether which one do you mean one more consistent with? Do you want the margin to be measured consistently on the same basis?
It seems to me the whole thing is to try to avoid a mismatch, to reduce the extent of mismatches, this whole approach
well,
of...
Well, those who support it are actually not stating that that's the objective.
What is our objective? We have a system of participating contracts, and we want to have some linkage between the valuation of assets and the valuation of liabilities, which I describe in short as avoiding mismatches.
Then remember, you're talking about the insurer's share, which doesn't have a thing to match against, so mismatches are not really the feature for the insurer's share. What you're talking about is effectively the pattern of recognition of the insurer's income from these contracts. And
is
I don't think that's a
mismatch. It's the CSM issue, right? It's consistency in calculating CSM
that's
during
correct.
The life of the contract.
Yes.
This is their argument.
That's, yes. That's 49A, yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Even if they're not expressing it as being designed to deal with accounting mismatches, when industry is talking about this form of unlocking, are they doing A or B?
B.
So while I would agree that if we were to go down this path, A perceptually is the more defensible, I think we need to be a bit wary of designing some massive mousetrap that then isn't accepted.
I can see the theoretical merits of chasing C, because if we start way back at why we would have got ourselves into this place in the first place, it was because we thought this was a fee. It was an implicit fee, and therefore to say, well, what is the fee that you would have charged if this had really been a fee, has got a theoretical merit. But then I would agree with everybody else who said the problem is it's a fantasy number. There's so many other things that we're introducing into the space here that it makes it very, very difficult. My concern of losing sight of that completely is that you may end up with a fee that doesn't actually represent the underlying service being delivered. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I think in one of the other discussions we've had, we've talked about if I had a 90-10 contract and I promised you simply the return on an index, and all I did on day one was bought the index and sat back and waited. Well, is 10% really an appropriate fee for what I'm doing? And I think that's the concern with not applying C, is that you may end up calling something an implicit fee that is totally inappropriate for the service that you're delivering for that fee. Mm-hmm. Same time, if I accept that C is out of there because of the difficulty of the operation, the difficulty of getting there, you do inherently fall back to A as the answer that makes most sense in the context of what we're trying to do here. But I hear what Sue's argument is too, that we're perhaps going along a particular route because we think this is what people want. I think we need to be careful of if we were to give them something, giving them something that they don't want at the end of the day. I'd still come back to my very first comment on the whole topic, but I just don't think there's a right space to go through it.
Yeah, and I think we can talk about it by itself, to know that, you know, C sounds like it's off the table because of operational complexity, and people recognize that A is a conceptual answer, but there might be circumstances why B would be more appropriate. We can at least, staff can at least explore that further, and that's helpful, and it narrows down the staff work. So if there are any no further comments, we can move on to book you.
Yes, please.
Yeah. So now the next section of the paper again deals with not whether you should do group deal. It's really more that in the last discussion we didn't really have time to discuss the mechanics and also the appropriate scope that if you were to use group deal. And again, staff thinks it's just as important to discuss those issues because it affects the cost benefits of doing so. So firstly, it's in from paragraph 61 to 65 onwards. The booking approach really is an approach to derive a discount rate, and we use that discount rate to discount the cash flows to decide what are the amounts we recognize as profit and loss, and therefore the remainder goes to OCI. It is not a question of measurement. It is a question of presentation between P&L and OCI, and it only counts when you have an OCI, in essence. You would need to construct this book yield at every reporting period, so you need to do a curve. What you will need to do is look to the underlying items held at that date, how those items are accounted for. This is quite key. So if those items are at cost, you use the cost type revenue that's coming from those items. If those items are fair value P&L, you need to take into account those fair value gains and losses in constructing this yield curve. And then you need to, when you, those assets are no longer expected to be on your books, you need to then continue on with the yield curve. And here you need to use some sort of expectations of the current yield. We have laid out the question, a very high level summary of the mechanics of the book year approach in paragraph 61 to 65 and appendix A. So the question here is, if you notice, there are a few open questions still on some of the mechanics of the approach. And I just wanted to give the board members whether they had any questions or comments about some of those mechanics.
Just a naive question, I would say. So you said it's just that OCI and profit loss issue, so it's not a measurement issue. So
yes,
we rejected the, to use book yield as a measurement issue.
Yep.
Could you recap why?
Sorry?
Could you recap why?
Why? Because it doesn't affect how you measure the liability on the balance sheet.
Yeah.
The liability is measured on the balance sheet using the present value of the cash flows, discounted using whatever discount rate we say is under the insurance standard.
Are you asking why we rejected it?
Why we rejected it?
Why we're not using the procurement?
Yeah, because it's a part. We are going to discuss the participation feature.
Right.
So therefore, to some extent, you could say that book yield is a good, you know, method of measurement.
It's only a really good method of measurement when the assets have a real link with the liability. So here we get into the situation where, you know, that the underlying items drive the actual payments paying out.
But actually, what we are trying to do is quite similar to what the mirroring is.
There is one difference, and this is that our liability is a current market consistent discount rate. The book yield takes into account whether the underlying items are at cost or fair value. If all the assets were fair value, you should get very same answers. They're very similar but not the same, because there might be still characteristics of the liability that are different from the assets. Liquidity, for example, so it's putting aside. But the real difference as well is the fact that you could have cost assets, which doesn't reflect the current market discount rate.
So may I put it this way? Book yield is not a derivative of mirroring.
It depends what you want to make it to be.
It has similarities in some aspects, and it's also got differences and how similar or different.
Yes.
So it partly depends on what sort of mechanics you mentioned.
I think that's the question. If you wanted to be an objective-based, like the mirroring, then you would drive to pointing it to some different mechanics, or you know, saying that the mechanics need to work in these ways.
Yeah.
heroic.
I was probably going to say something very similar to what you're mentioning here, is that I'm inclined to think of the book yield approach as mirroring the just for presentation purposes, splitting profit and loss and income statement. Splitting profit and loss and OCI. The difficulty, obviously, is that a lot of concerns were raised around the mechanics of mirroring, particularly the splitting of cash flows and all those sorts of things. And I think once we start trying to resolve those issues, it feels to me like this becomes very difficult. Mm-hmm. That said, I still have something of an attraction for the book yield approach, because it feels to me like the book yield approach is trying to achieve what we're trying to achieve with the accounting policy option between OCI and profit and loss for non-PAR contracts. This is a more regulated, more constrained way of doing it for PAR contracts. Mm-hmm. But it tries to achieve a similar thing. It also has the same benefit that if you choose not to have this complexity in your life, we could say that as you have the option to go full fair value in non-PAR contracts, you could equally have the option to go full fair value here. And likewise, it's got the additional benefit that you are keeping the measurement of the liability consistent, which I think is an improvement on our 2013 review, because we actually have one way of measuring the liability is presented in a consistent manner. I do understand some of the issues that you've raised in the paper with regard to the mechanics of things like equity instruments and property. I'm not sure they're insoluble. I would love to find an answer in the space.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's, in my mind, remember that you did have a model for participating contracts where the liability was measured on a current basis, you know, using a current discount rate, and mirroring was an exception, putting it aside, and you did have a P&L OCI split in that case, and, you know, you have comments around that as well. So you have also to consider that there are alternatives out there, and you need to weigh up how beneficial or costly your this alternative versus another. So what is the attraction for book yield for you? It sounds to me like this addressing the accounting mismatch.
I think it achieves the accounting mismatch issue that we were trying to fix with mirroring.
Sure.
But puts it in the context of the OCI split, so presentation split, which is something that we've already sort of started to speak towards as being an option. Mm-hmm. That means that it does create complexity, but it creates complexity for those who choose to take the complexity.
Yep.
It sorts out the issue that is a real issue to me, which is the accounting mismatch.
Sure.
So it's not an economic issue, which you might argue, for example, the previous discussion we had was more about the economics of the contract. This is simply about trying to resolve an accounting mismatch issue.
Yep.
And so that feels more like us trying to solve the problem. And I think it's consistent with the non-PAR model, but putting a few more bells and whistles around the non-PAR solution.
Yeah, and I think we need to do further analysis on it. But what would you do for investment properties and equities?
So my inclination on those ones and is to look at the actual yield in the current period on those assets, because that's effective. It doesn't matter what the present value of what the fair value of an equity. In fact, an equity is a bad example because it's carrying the fair value. But if you were carrying the equity at fair value OCI, which I suppose you can. The thing that comes through the income statement is the dividend. That's all that comes through. So a yield based on dividend does have a certain sense if what you're trying to achieve is to resolve the mismatch that's been created by the accounting.
And can I take it further? Because you need to build a yield curve of all your future cash flow. So what would you do for the next year, the year after next, and the year after that?
Expected dividends has the problem that what are expected dividends? I'd like to explore, at least understand what the effect would be using of simply rolling out that exact yield that you've got, extending the yield that you've got in the current period. Because anything else is going to give you a different profit and loss reflection for the same instrument.
And you would do the same for any instrument then? Bonds would be the same?
Bonds, you're effectively doing it by taking the EIR of the bond that was fixed at the date. If I've got a bond at fair value OCI, I'm taking the EIR, which is the expected performance over the life at a fixed rate.
And how about after the bond is meant to mature? you would just simply keep that year out to the future?
No, it can only extend as far as the underlying asset extends. So book yield relates to the, which again comes to the scope, I guess, because you have to have the underlying assets. I don't think you can take this from a virtual set of underlying assets.
The bond matures in 10 years. What do you do after 10 years? Do you still keep the ARR?
You have to
then. Or assume to investment.
Yeah. So I'm trying to draw the parallel here. Yeah.
So it seems that if you have to look at the current value of what you would replace that bond as today.
And why wouldn't you do the same with the dividend yield? That's the thing I'm struggling with.
Because you're not going, the asset that you're looking at, which is the shares, is not going to be replaced in 10 years.
But your dividends might change. It's the same, in the bond, all you're doing is your expectation that your interest revenue is going to change after you reinvest. But the dividends, equally, they could give you a different performing dividend on year two, year three, to year infinitum.
The thing is that you're not taking that into account your asset valuation, even though you have the asset. Whereas on the bond, you're not taking into account the asset valuation, but that's because you don't have the asset. I'm not saying that this is the solution. I think this is a solution that I would really want to spend a amount of time on.
Sure, then we can do that. I'm just trying to understand what your intentions are for you. Yeah.
And I'm not going to put my little flag here for you.
I'm a bit struggling with the complexity of that approach. And especially, it seems to me we have now two discount rates. One to measure the liability, which is determined top-down, or traditional approach. And one which is derived from the book. And there is probably some connection, some relationship between those two rights. Because even though you do a top-down approach from the assets to go to your liabilities, and then calculate another one which is based on the actual portfolio for this approach of the book yield, they are related. They could move more or less in sync or more or less independently from each other. Right? So when you remeasure the discount rate on the liability, take it to OCI, it's fine. But what happens then to the effect on the book yield? It goes where? If you remeasure the book yield the same time, or do you just freeze it? You freeze it at the beginning for the allocation purpose, and you don't remeasure it?
You do need to measure the book yield every period.
Every period?
Every
right.
period. You come up with a new yield curve every period based on the book yield approach.
How do the two remeasurements interact?
Well, the difference between, you have the same set of cash flows. You use the book yield approach to get you how much you need to record in P&L. The difference between the liability measurement and the amount in P&L is what goes to OCI. Yeah.
So the book would work as a cap, say, to what is going to the P&L.
Steve?
On the day contract is originated, my understanding is that book yield is exactly the same as the discount rate that will be applied in measuring the balance sheet amount.
Well, I think that's a practical expedient for those people who are suggesting it. Because it's conceptually not the same thing as your liability discount rate.
Well, how can it not be? Because presumably on the day the contract originates, there can be no OCI on that day.
There's no OCI, but conceptually it's the asset or the underlying items yield. And let's say you have a liquidity difference between your balance sheet. You know, your liability has a different liquidity character than the assets that you finally invest in. It's conceptually a different idea.
Okay, so how can you have a day one OCI amount?
It's just simply, like anything else, it's the difference between those two calculations of the liability on day one. The way to get around it is to force it to the liability amount.
But then you have to unwind the first amount.
Well, no, you have a catch-up adjustment.
If you put to one side the equities through OCI and the investment properties through OCI, which arguably they shouldn't be there in the first place, but that's a complication. So you just have bonds. The locked in, the book yield of the bond is the return on the bond on day one.
of the bond.
So therefore, why is the book yield on day one not the same as the discount rate that you would apply in measuring the balance sheet amount on day one?
Because you have difference in liquidity between the bond and your actual liability. Your liability could be around for much longer.
Steve, are you just saying that on day one, all of the book yield will be P&L because you haven't yet had any revaluation through OCI?
Yes.
Yeah. Well,
the rate may be different, but on day one, 100% of the book yield would be P&L because there's been no changes in fair value through OCI of the assets. But Joanna, you're making the point that the book yield will be based on the nature and returns of the assets, not the liability.
But
Steve's point is, yeah, but on day one they'll both be wholly in P&L.
Yes, they'll be wholly in P&L only because for the asset, the EIR equals the fair value, if you like, the discount rate used to get the fair value in the same point. So at that point in time, they match. Because there is no difference conceptually because the EIR sets to the fair value amount for the bond. For the liability, it's not quite the same case because the liability is your liability discount rate. So yes, you're paying back these bond returns, but you also meant to take into account other characteristics of the liability. So the bonds are liquid, they're traded on the open market. Your liability is not. You can't then just use the current discount rate of the bond. You would have to adjust it for any differences in liquidity.
Okay, this was a bit of a surprising answer. I wasn't anticipating it. So,
but the people who are suggesting this approach would say, as a practical expedient, we just assume that the book yield on the day one, because nobody likes a mounting OCI on day one, as the balance sheet amount.
Can I just explore this a bit further, which is not actually the question I was going to ask. So if I have a policy that pays me 100% of the returns on the assets, and let's just ignore insurance for the moment, just, I know it's not an insurance contract, but just to isolate the participation, and I invest that 100% of the assets I give in liquid bonds, to my mind, the liability would equal the assets, and there would be a zero CSM in that situation. But you're suggesting that the liability would be measured differently from the assets because the liability is illiquid, therefore the liability would be higher than the amount of the assets, therefore you'd have an onerous contract.
No, you wouldn't have an onerous contract.
Well, if I pay a premium of 100 and the 100 is invested in liquid bonds, and you measure the liability at 105, which I think is what you're suggesting, you get a negative CSM of 5, so an onerous contract. That doesn't seem to make sense.
Yeah, the liability would be lower. The liability would be lower.
Yeah.
So you've made a profit from the fact that you've converted liquid assets.
And nobody can. I agree, just
the other way around. Oh,
see,
you've got a positive CSM. Yeah.
See, problem solved.
But
that's another complication,
though,
isn't it,
this whole thing? But, okay, can I go back to my original question? I'm not sure, I think you've used
up. There are different ways of measuring the balance sheet liability for participating contract, taking into account the asset linkage. You can look at the expected return on the assets, adjusted for illiquidity, or you could do some sort of risk-neutral valuation. And it seems to me that you can do different approaches to get to the same liability for a par contract by defining the cash flows differently, defining the different discount rate differently. Is the book yield an expected return but locked in, or is it a risk neutral return that's locked in?
Yeah, those who do suggest it seem to say it's a risk neutral return in some ways, or that it has some risk neutral properties. So we could do further investigation if you want to do into that. So those are the kind of questions we need to to know what you want to know more to investigate about this computer approach?
Well, I mainly ask it because of the future discussion we're going to have on effective yield.
Sure.
Because I think exactly the same issue applies there.
Yeah. So your question is, does it work when you use a risk-neutral type scenario?
Well, I think it works, but it gives a different answer.
Yes.
Give a different amount in P&L and OCI.
Absolutely. It does give you a different answer.
So I think if we were to do OCI, and there seems to be only two candidates for OCI, one is an effective yield, one is a book yield. If we were to do OCI, I think we would need to specify
one of the
quite
other.
Clearly how it's done.
Yeah. Fair enough. So the other indications that I'm going to pick out of that is you think investment properties and equities are a distraction? Do you think we shouldn't be exploring that?
Well, if I were to do book yield, I'd do it for fair value OCI bonds and bonds at cost.
Okay.
And I wouldn't give any accommodation to equities and investment properties. I would just assume that they were fair value P&L. And
to make it easier.
Yeah.
Investment properties have to be either fair value P&L or not fair value OCI.
That's right.
They can be at cost,
but
the amount that goes in the P&L is not like a bond yield. It's not an EIR calculation. It's something different, which is why the problems have arisen with properties and equities. There is no EIR for some.
It is more complicated to do. Okay. So, any other questions or comments? So we've discussed mechanics, and there's two views quite opposed about what we're going to do in the mechanics. But the other question is, again, scope. When do you think it's appropriate to link the presentation of amounts in P&L to how the underlying items are accountable? This is the question that we posed to you in paragraph 66 to 69 of the paper. Again, what we are asking for are tentative directions to direct staff work, so that in future papers when we discuss cost benefits and mechanics, we understand already what you think the scope should be for these contracts to apply. In the paper, we discuss again the same criteria, so I won't go into it, as it's the same criteria in fact that when we discuss for the insurance share of underlying items. Now I will point out that some people think you might need to have the same criteria. Some people think, well, you could have different criteria because this is presentation, whereas unlocking for the shareholder share to them, they saw it more as measurement because it affects the margin, which means you affect how much your liability is, your total liabilities. So for this question, which is in paragraph 69, can I get an indication, tentative direction, on what you think about these criteria? Question four.
I have a question,
which
is you phrased question four as were to require, and so you're viewing this as potentially only a requirement rather than an option.
Sorry, I mean if you were to have the option for P&L, then it's you need to do this. It's not other forms of OCI. So yes, I was. If you were to do OCI, I would still say that you have the you have the question of P&L and OCI. But if you were to do OCI, this would be the method of doing it. To take Steve's point, that you got to specify the method of doing it if you were to allow OCI.
The only OCI line to be this.
Yes.
Steve.
On 67C, first paragraph, last two sentences, I didn't understand. Staff do not think book yield leaves significant differences to other alternatives in the unwind of the discount rate. The other alternatives being the effective yield.
Could you repeat
the 67C, at the bottom of page 25.
Third sentence.
Starting on page. To my mind, the book yield approach would lead to quite big differences in what goes in P&L and OCI compared with other methods.
Okay.
So that, but in any case, I couldn't work out the last sentence.
I guess, I think in certain circumstances, you get very similar answers. And I guess the circumstances I was thinking of is if you had substantial items that are bonds, you may, you know, it may be very close. It all depends. I take your point on duration and how long your liability is, but there might be some circumstances where you get very similar answers.
Until you sell the bonds.
Until you sell the bonds. And if you're selling your bonds, doesn't cause a reset in the discount rate.
Which is the key difference between book yield and effective yield.
Although I would argue that most of the time when you sell the bonds, you will cause a reset because it normally should affect your cash flows. But that's another second question.
Not so sure.
Yeah. But putting that aside, I think this is substantially more complex than what we had in the ED. And so that's my criterion C was just a way of saying, not for conceptual reasons or anything, just for complexity, is it really worth doing it if you only pay passing on 5% share? You know, to go and measure the whole 100 of all that you have to get the and some sort of discount rate from the yields of that. So I was just trying to narrow it and say, only do it where you think it makes gives you answers that makes economic sense, useful sense, but also cost and complexity for the preparer.
Yes, almost same point. Paragraph 67C, the first three lines, you said it's the stock view. In the stock view, an economic match between the underlying items and the liability could occur even when the policyholder does not receive a substantial share of the returns.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of situation do you have in your mind?
I mean, economic match is just the fact that when there is a change, that change affects the liability and the assets in the same way. So they're just, you know, there's no accounting mismatch, there's an economic match. So the situation I was thinking about is if you just pay 5% of your general account assets, it's just 5%. You still have a linkage to your general account, but you're just paying 5%. So that it's still matched with what happens to the general account, but it's only 5%.
Yeah.
And so, but there's still a match. It's still 5% of whatever happens to your general account. So then I was thinking, yes, that can occur, and there are contracts out there like that. The question then is it worth for them to go and measure the book yield based on the entire portfolio that's in your general account?
So then, but you said, it is possible, but because of the cost constraint, overweight.
Yeah.
But as you repeatedly said, that it's the discretion of the preparer care to take that cost and complexity. So that's why we don't really care the cost and the complexity of the deal. So if that is the case, the truth, the notion, then why do we have to have a constraint of that?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. There's two ways of addressing cost and complexity. One is to say that, well, they can always avoid OCI if it's too complex by choosing the P&L option. That's one way of doing it. But the way I was also thinking about it is you have an OCI approach that is different to the spooky approach that was exposed in the ED. And sure, they want some tweaks to it, but some people are happy with that OCI approach. And therefore, for them, it's the complexity of you know, they were happy with that OCI approach, you want them now to do this more complex OCI approach.
But it doesn't necessarily explain why we have to have a third condition.
Yes, you could delete it if you wanted to.
Give them an option. In order to achieve what Ryan described, we need to allow them an option of liability share approach or P&L.
That's what I was getting at, much more fumbling matter when I asked the question about question four and why was it worded as would require an entity rather than permit an entity. Because if you were going to require it, then I think that's when.
Well, I think
you
there's,
want to require
there's too many, just for clarity. Would you give an option for different OCI approaches?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Option, yeah.
So this is different to what Steve was saying that if you were to do OCI, you only do it this one approach. That
for the contracts within the scope?
Yeah.
Do you either widen the scope so that more contracts within the scope of doing the book yard approach, you provide an option for some of those contracts to do the AD OCI approach, or you keep the scope narrow, and then for the participating contracts which don't meet the scope requirements, but we still need some kind of reset, you still do the reset as proposed in the ED, and on top of both of those OCI approaches, you have an option to go to P&L.
So on top of the confusion of having a discussion about something we haven't decided whether or not we're going to do or not, we're now confusing it further by implying that, you know, we're suddenly all open to making it optional. So in addition to potentially having a complicated book yield approach and choices in the main model of OCI or not OCI, we might then layer on top of that a choice of using the complex book yield approach or doing something different.
I guess that's what
TAP is. So I think that's one of the things we need to, you know, I don't want to create an impression that we're all open to it being optional, even if we were open to it in the first place. But secondly, again, if this were either optional, or if there's conditions such as if I hold the assets and it's not required to hold the assets, so again you've got this flip-flopping it in and out, we're going to have to do some analysis to see if everything unwinds properly. If we've done these allocations and then we're midway through the life of an insurance contract, you switch over and don't use the book yield approach anymore.
Yeah, you need some sort of reclassification.
And when can you flip in and out if we're going to have options? We're going to have now a discussion about when options would apply potentially here as well as when options would apply in the main one.
I guess we need direction for you. Do you want to pursue an approach that's a required, if you do OCI, you need to use book yield approach in when your contracts meet the scope, or would you make it optional and there would be different OCI approaches that they could apply?
One option's enough.
I'm not ready to answer your new question. I was back on the previous one, which is the tax analysis was coming from the let it prepare to decide whether or not the added complexity, you know, is worth it in terms of benefit. But echoing Sue's comment, I have some concerns about how complex it is to be an investor and pick up three sets of financial statements of three different insurers and understand the interplay of all the different elections, so that while Tuck as a preparer may be willing to undertake the complexity to get maybe a more finely tuned presentation, will somebody who's looking at several insurance companies be able to wade through all the elections, understand what they are and what the impact is? So greater optionality on its own raises concerns for me about comparability.
So where I think we are at the moment is in terms of non-par, we have OCI or P&L with an option, a kind of policy choice. On the participating contracts, we're talking about if we use a book yield approach and we feel a need to restrict the application of the book yield approach to some but not all participating contracts, you're looking there at least two different types of OCI, and it could be required between them. And at some point, we're going to ask you a question about whether or not you want to commit an option for either of those OCI participating contract, which is to go to P&L, or whether you want to meet the OCI requirement. I think we have to ask that question, at least for that option. Optionality between OCI approaches, I hadn't envisaged when we started this discussion.
And it sounds like there's not much appetite for it.
For me, the optionality among different yields you will use or the company will use or we allow to use is different from optionality, for example, OCI or profit loss. You know, it's because, you know, you remember long time ago we went through several problems to specify methodology to measure the risk adjustment. Then people say, why you want to, you know, specify? Because company may have different, you know, historical reasons use, and maybe different country may have different terminologies, you know, Amaro and I remember. And in this area, I'm not sure is because of the difference within the detail of the methodology or difference which is so big like OCI or profit loss. If my concern is, you know, if we say it's only one, let's assume book yield, and maybe it fits some, you know, test taste of some of the insurance companies, but may not fit to others. I'm not sure you then put back the question to you. The opportunity, how big issue will be, you know, compared to.
I think there's a difference between in the risk adjustment where there was an objective of what it was supposed to portray and what we're doing in OCI at the moment, which has been centered around a choice of over methodology. And it seems to me that perhaps we are lacking the real objective of why we're using OCI in some ways. Now, we've heard some arguments that it's about eliminating accounting mismatch, and that's what the Book Hill is kind of aiming at, and it works when it works. And you could either say you could do your best to work out how to eliminate all accounting mismatches and just put the rest into OCI. I think, judging from the discussion we've had around the table before, that that's what we felt to be a little bit too open for many. And that means that we're looking at specifying some kind of methodology for OCI. And I think it's a different sort of consideration than for the risk adjustment.
Again, you know, in terms of optionalities, we have the, you know, bottom up. There are many areas, you know, we are not able to specify only one.
But there the objective is clear. I don't think we have as yet got a clear objective of why we think we're wanting to use OCI other than making profit and loss.
Disaggregate amounts that changes the discount rates.
Which doesn't really apply.
Stephen, let's then come.
I'm troubled by options, and I just wouldn't use OCI at all for any contract to solve the whole problem. The reason why I'm attracted to the, if we're going to use OCI, the reason I'm attracted to the book yield approach is because it doesn't produce the problems that the approach did that we have for non-par. I think that creates a very misleading P&L. The split between P&L and OCI, people are going to really struggle to interpret it. Book yield is better. But actually, if we're going to use OCI, I'd use book yield for all contracts, including non-par.
Where would you say on the investment properties and the equities?
Well,
you only for the bond
effect. Yeah, for the bond
element. So you use it even if I promise an index return on the FTSE 500 and I hold bonds?
Which book yield?
The book yield in this scenario would be
the
bond.
The underlying.
I haven't thought about where you're doing a participation on something other than the assets that you hold. Think about that. But
that's the same as
non-par.
I think that's quite a critical.
Yeah, but in there, I'm not providing any return. I'm just providing whatever the cash flows are.
It's zero return.
If we're going to put something into OCI for the liability, it seems to me to make sense to make it consistent with how we're using OCI for the assets.
Okay.
I still don't think it's a good approach.
Yeah.
If you want to use OCI, I think this is better than the alternative, but
with some
the best approach is just not to use it in the first place.
Yeah. And you would do book yield, but with modifications. Only do it when it bonds.
Well, I guess I'm more objecting to the alternative.
Yeah.
Rather than supporting
the yield. Right, okay. It's the least bad.
It's the least bad.
Okay. Because your first preference is P&L.
I'm fearful of where we will end up, where we'll have the same problems with par that we have with non-par, which is why I objected to non-par in the first place.
So can I get an indication of board members whether these were the appropriate criteria?
Question 4, page 26.
69. Paragraph 69.
I would certainly be prone to limit it the way you suggest it.
Yeah.
Because I'm inclined to see the circumstances in this narrow form of contract as being I'm going to take the asset and use the asset to settle my obligation. So I'm comfortable in that circumstance that the liability accounting should reflect the asset accounting. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of sympathy with what Steve just said in terms of broadening it completely. I just don't think that's doable.
Okay.
So I'm comfortable with that.
Who else is comfortable with the scope?
Wait,
very much.